Is this Crazy Deb?
This is Crazy Deb.
What's going on, my fellow Scorpio?
Well, you know, in lockdown, and I'm in Mexico, and seems like we got another 3 or 4 weeks to go before we're let out of the house.
When we were texting, you seemed surprised that I read your book. Am I not your target demo?
Well, I would like to say you are, but probably not. I'm not certain your age. I'm thinking 30, late 30s, maybe 40. I don't know. And NYPD, I was a little surprised, but thrilled, to say the least. Very, very happy.
Okay, let's get to it. If I told 100 people that a former correction officer and hairdresser is writing a book, I'm sure that 99% of them would have thought you'd be writing a book based on your days as a correction officer, but no, on hairdressing. But I'm glad you did, because Debbie, I mean this, 5 stars on Goodreads. I absolutely loved your book. Tell everyone about the book I just read and give a brief description on it, please.
Well, I started, I went to New York right after 9/11, and I worked at Ground Zero helping the firefighters, you know how it was when everybody was going and trying to help. I actually did massage therapy for the firefighters. And when I got back to Michigan, I was not ready to move forward. And I started watching everything I could get my hands on about Afghanistan. And I had the opportunity to go to Afghanistan with also a disaster relief team. But I was absolutely useless because they were all medical and I'm a hairdresser. They had me doing laundry and like making signs for people's doors. I was really, really useless. And so I snuck off shopping a lot, but I wound up doing hair when they found out that there was a hairdresser in the country. They were thrilled, and I brought my scissors and a cape with me, and I wound up being so busy because all the reporters and every TV station was there, missionaries that had been driving the Khyber Pass for, you know, 12 hours to get foils. Everybody wanted their hair done, kind of like now how everybody wants their hair done. And, you know, you're doing, like, underground hairdressing, or, you know, it feels like you're doing, like, a drug deal sometimes. It's like people are trying to get me to do their hair. Like, it's crazy. So, yeah, so that was it. And I started doing hair. But what I didn't understand was why there was a problem and why I was in such high demand. And so I started looking into the salons there, realized that they had all gone underground because it become illegal to even wear makeup or fingernail polish, get your hair done, that sort of stuff. But as hair prevails, people were doing underground hair salons, and they had not had a lot of formal training by this time because there'd been war for so long. And so I was in Afghanistan and I thought, you know what, I'm going to come back and I think I'm going to put a school in. And that's what I did.
And now you grew up in Holland, Michigan. Normal childhood? Everything was just a normal growing up kid?
I was a normal kid growing up. I was always a little on the eccentric side. Or maybe creative. I'm going to call it creative. I was always creative, and I was always an entrepreneur. Like, I was selling something to somebody or making something. I was that kid, right? Like, I didn't sit still that long. Well, you know, you're a Scorpio. Come on. You don't even need to ask me these questions, do you? You know exactly how my head was sinking. It's like, I think I can fix this. And you know what? It's that drive, that curiosity, because going to the Scorpio nature, we have this curiosity for different cultures, different people, how people are thinking, how people are doing. And and we jump in, and it's all or nothing. And that's what I did. I jumped in.
Now, besides, you say you're curious, your different careers and stuff. Was writing always something you enjoyed? Was it always back in your head? Maybe you wanted to write a book, or were you always a big writer, or no?
You know what? I was always a big writer, but I never, ever dreamed I would write a book. I always thought the big day for me, I love going to bookstores and airports because I love to fly. Mm-hmm. And so my big tradition is every time I'd go to an airport, I'd go to the bookstore, I'd buy a book, and that would be my travel companion on the flight. And so I always thought, how cool would that be to see your book in an airport? But that was as far as I took it. But I wrote all the time. I wrote a lot of sketches and a lot of little one-act plays, but I never went down the path of actually writing a book. But when I was in Afghanistan, because everybody was kind of curious. They thought I was CIA or something, because why would a hairdresser, what are you doing? Because everybody's there, there's like mercenaries, there's every kind of character, good, bad, ugly, everything you can imagine. But there wasn't really hairdressers there, but I mean, everything else. And, people were smuggling in alcohol and, everybody was creating businesses from the ground up, but there wasn't very many hairdressers. And so when I said, what do you do in Afghanistan? I said, well, I'm a hairdresser. And it was like, okay, perfect cover. And so because everybody did go through the beauty shop, right? Like all the, embassy people, UN, I did have everybody go through. And so the beauty shop kind of was like a United Nations of relief workers and everybody who was doing something, reporters. It was really, really interesting to just look out to see who was in your salon.
And we didn't mention yet, but the Kabul Beauty School, An American Woman Goes Behind the Veil. I have to ask you this, because you pushed and pleaded to go to Afghanistan. It wasn't like, hey, you're up next, you're going here. You wanted to go there. What was your initial reaction, Michigan girl, landing in Afghanistan?
Well, it was really weird when you land. There was like all the bombed out planes and shot up planes. So you're landing and the first thing you see is war zone paraphernalia, and you're thinking, this can't be possible. And then when you get in the car and you're driving, it looked like you had just gone back about 2,000 years. It just did not seem possible that this was now. And but what I found was the hospitality and the generosity of the Afghans. It's impossible to go to Afghanistan and not fall in love with the people and the culture. And I mean, yeah, it was a war zone, and yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on there and a lot of tribal issues, and it's a tribal culture, but that you will never meet the most resilient and compassionate and wonderful people. And it was that draws you in, it sucks you in, and literally it's hard to get out of it because you don't want to leave. I mean, it's hard when you're there because, you don't have water. Sometimes you don't have electricity. And, things are tough. But there's something so satisfying. You could do more with your life in 24 hours. You could help and make a difference in more people's lives in 24 hours there than what you could do in a lifetime here.
Now
and so I think
I'm sorry.
No, I just think that was what was so my driving force.
Now, you initially went there just looking to help. You didn't, your intention wasn't like, okay, I'm heading to Afghanistan to open up a salon. You wanted to go there just to help any way possible, correct?
Right. Originally, when I first went there, I went with a team. And then I was there for a month, and I knew I needed to come back, but I knew that the team was probably going to say, well, maybe not with us, because I, again, was useless. And so I knew that if I was going to go back, I had to go back on my own. I knew that I had to figure it out, and I knew that I was going to go back, and I knew it was going to be hairdressing, and I knew I was going to put a school in. I knew that. And I just had to figure out, put all those pieces together, which is tricky.
Yeah, how does that process happen? Not just open up in a store in Afghanistan because you're a woman, but an American woman. So how'd that whole process even happen? The difficulties?
Well, you do have to work within. I worked within the women's ministry, so that women could have a protected area to go to school. And there was a guy, an Afghan Australian that did a lot of the in-between stuff. And you can't do it on your own. You have to have people help you. It's impossible. It's too big and it's too complicated, and you don't know the language.
Now, this is a silly question because I've been to a lot of Muslim countries, and most, if not all, of the women there are covered up. Were you surprised at the amount of Afghan women that wanted just to be made up with makeup and haircuts and look beautiful? Did that surprise you?
You know what? It did a little bit, because I wasn't quite familiar with the culture of basically how made up they are under the burqa. And in Central Asia, like Afghanistan and Pakistan, India, and the Arab countries, the women, whether they are veiled or covered or not, they are definitely they thought us American women were really plain. And I always wore quite a bit of makeup, right? But it was like I was like frumpy compared to them. I mean, they had eyelashes on, and I mean the whole bit, they were dolled up under there. And so I thought, I like that. And so yeah, so I was a little surprised, but it was really interesting.
Now, you developed some special friendships there. What's the difference between having friends there and over here in the States? What's the biggest difference?
I think that, okay, so I could go to an Afghan that's in the States. It doesn't matter, they're Afghan. I could say, I've got a flight coming in at 2 o'clock in the morning, and it would not matter. They would come and get me. They'd bring me to their house, and they would have a full blown meal set up for me. Like, I'm talking like 7 courses at 3 o'clock in the morning. The hospitality is past anything you can even wrap your head around. It is, the hospitality is amazing. I mean, they will, when you're a friend, they will die for you. I mean, they really take on the friendship to a different level.
You were living there and coming back home. You mentioned you were there for a month. How many times, and what was the frequency of the trips from Afghanistan back to Michigan?
Well, in the beginning, I went for a month, and then I came back, and I had to gather, I had to try to figure out how do I get stuff? How do I do this? I'm a hairdresser in Michigan that has not. I was so clueless, really. And so I had to get all my stuff together. I had to get all the product. I had to get the shipping containers over. I had to get salon stations, all that stuff. I needed money. I needed to raise money. I needed to do everything. There needed to be, I I partnered up with a woman that was working and had been working with L'Oreal, and I had been working with Paul Mitchell. And, you know, we just had, I went back just a couple times. I went back, I must have gone back in February. But then I knew that I couldn't keep coming and going because, first of all, it was too expensive. Mm-hmm. And I decided that this was it. And after the second time that I went, I decided that I was going to go and I was going to stay. Because there's no way you could be running. You couldn't have people coming and going, trainers and stuff like that. It was just too expensive. And realizing that it seemed to be really easy to get stuff, but it was really tough to get money. And so, yeah, it was. I mean, I had shipping containers. You know, Paul Mitchell was so generous, and, you know, all the beauty salons, I mean, all the companies, they were very, very generous. But it was, raising the money was the tricky part. So, and then when you rent anything, I had some issues with the women's ministry, and they like barred me from there because they decided they wanted to put their own school in. Mm-hmm. So that meant then I had to rent, and renting, you have to pay a year's rent up front, and rent was not cheap. I mean, you would get a bombed out building and you were paying, you know, New York prices. It was very expensive.
So when did the when did the beauty school officially open?
2002.
And I know you just mentioned the rent, but what other hurdles?
2003. It opened in 2003. Sorry.
And now, what other hurdles did you face besides the rent? Was it a language, maybe the men there, clientele? What other hurdles did you face opening up this school?
You know, I think, you know, the language barrier was tough in the beginning. Because it was, there was no real order on how things should be done. So everything was, it was always tomorrow, 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 tomorrow. And, you know, so you never had exact ideas. Everybody worked in their own, you know, their own pace, and that was tough. And you know, Afghanistan could make you crazy that way because it was, you know, nobody was on time, and you just had the bureaucracy was very young, right? They didn't, it hasn't, had not been this government for very long. And it was just all new. Everything was new, all these. And so it was really tricky to deal with that. And then, you know, as a woman, I'm trying to, you know, boss the men around, right? Because I need things done. Mm-hmm. And needed it done now, right? And it's like that I had to be careful, because it's like I wanted, they, you know what, they don't think of us foreign women as like women. We're like man women, right? Like we're a whole different gender. So the boundaries that I had were way different than the rules that the Afghan women had. I didn't have those same rules. So I could operate like a woman, but yet they weren't surprised because they thought we acted like men because we took charge. We did things, you know. So, but finding those, I know that I stepped on, you know, some real cultural faux pas. You know, looking back, I'm sure that I must have, but, you know, just trying to get something done, and you just can't, there's like two layers of the story going at the same time. The one that's really happening, the one that they're telling you that's happening. And so trying to decipher between all of that was tricky. It was tricky. And then, you know, and we don't have electricity. I mean, that was really hard. And we, you know, and you know, trying to get anything there. Like, I needed to, in order to have a class, I needed to have mannequin heads. I needed 10 mannequin heads. There's no mannequin heads there. I had to fly to Dubai to get everything. So, I mean, hair color. If I didn't have it, I had to, you know, try to procure it. And just all the little things that are so easy that you just go to the store and you get or you order, can't get it.
Now, you mentioned a few of the fights you had there. And you had a lot of wacky stories there and a lot of showdowns. And I know you can't fight every single day, but I'm sure you wanted to. What made you pick and choose what was worth fighting for? Not even with the mannequin heads, but even with the women there defending people, stories with you with guns. What made you pick and choose your fights?
Well, you know what? I don't know if, honestly, I probably don't know if I was picking and choosing my fights wisely. you're living in, it was almost like a vortex, right? And you're living in this world where everybody has a gun. And you don't know the bad guys from the good guys. You don't know who's Taliban and who's not. You don't know anything, right? You're just hoping for the best. And you're hoping that people are the best. But it was really when the bad guys would hurt my girls or the husbands. I mean, I could do nothing about the husbands. That was the hard part because I could not get involved in a family thing because that wasn't my place and that could cause more trouble. But I would get so annoyed when these literal criminals were just running the show. And I had neighbors. They were bad guys, like literally bad guys. They had, you know, were kidnapping people. They were stealing vegetables from the vendors. And then they beat up my guard. And that was it. That was when Annie got her gun. And I was going to break down. But I had like pink fluffy slippers on. I was so mad. I thought, you know what? And I just, it was foolish. And I could have really gotten hurt. And I didn't, thank God. My son was in Afghanistan with me. And we reminisce. And when we say we have war stories, we really have war stories. And he says, you know, we're both lucky to be alive. And I'm thinking, yeah, you know, we were. We took a few risks that may not have been good. But I tell you, I would just get so, I was so angry. And I literally brought them, I made the police arrest them. I was going to arrest, they had to be arrested. And, you know, they just couldn't get away with hurting the women, beating up people, and, you know, kidnapping people. They couldn't stand it. And I thought, and they're my neighbors. And they just let them go. Like they says, you know, sorry, lady, but these bad guys are bigger than us. Ugh. And yeah. And so when I left the police station and I had to give them a ride home.
I love that part of the book.
Like, are you kidding me? It's like, oh, goodness. But before I left the compound, and so all the peacekeepers were there, right? And so there was a huge compound, and there was tanks, right? And they were all like these tanks, and they were our guys, or they're the peacekeepers. And so I went up, and I think the guy was Dutch or something, and I says, hey, can you can you do something about this? You know, I told him my story, and he says, well, you know, we're peacekeepers. I don't, there's really not much we can do. I says, can you bring your tanks and just point them at that house? And so, because there's no street, there's no road signs. So I drew a map, and I said, and this is my house. I had camels on my wall. This is my house, and the one next door are the bad guys. So, you know, I was friends with the vice president at that time. And, you know, they're saying, you know, well, Debbie, you better stay in your compound because I think you've really pissed off, you know, some really bad people. And so the next thing I know, the guard comes and he says, I think the door's for you. And so I go outside and they had surrounded the house with these tanks. And I thought, good. I knocked on the door and I just basically said, don't F with us anymore. And I said, and I pointed to the tanks that were all pointed to his door. So,
and I know. Did the problems end right there?
What?
Did the problems end right there then, I'm assuming?
It did. Absolutely. And then, yep, it was done. And, you know, the thing is I think about 3 or 4 weeks later, I can't remember. There was somebody in the house that was watching like a shoot 'em up TV, and I could hear these guns in the background. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking, though, that sounds really close. And it didn't sound like TV. And I looked outside my window and I could look into their courtyard, and somebody was raiding that house. And the next thing, they were all taken out.
You have to keep in mind now that my last three interviews was a CIA agent, a UFC fighter, and a boxer. So the fact that you have me asking the next question just shows what a great book this was. Can you please explain the weddings there in Afghanistan and, more importantly, the makeup that you did for them? Because I read this chapter in amazement, and I've traveled all over, and I never knew with the makeups and the weddings. Can you explain it? Because this was my favorite part of the book.
What part of the wedding you mean, like?
Well, both, just the makeup, the way they get the makeup done, and then like the two rooms. That just blew my mind, and how they danced and everything.
Oh, those separate weddings.
Yes.
Well, you know, so the first thing, you need to be hairless. So, like, that's the first thing that happens is you must be hairless. And so that's the big thing. Everything is gone. And then the makeup is unbelievable and sparkly and glittery, and the hair is big. And then you go and there is a big wedding hall, and there is a curtain down the middle of it. And the men are on one side and the women are on the other side. And the groom, some of the weddings that I went to, the groom actually is allowed into the girl's side. But, oh, it's two separate parties. Absolutely. And they are just, it's crazy. And they're dancing. They're having so much fun. But separate parties. And I think that's kind of, in a lot of areas, is pretty common.
You really embraced the culture there, which I loved. I have to ask you, why didn't you learn the language? It was blowing my mind, Deb.
I did. By the time I left, I had it.
Okay, because I was during the book, I'm like, Debbie, you're so smart. You do everything. Why are you not learning the language? I was getting mad at you.
Well, you know, I did actually have to learn. I mean, it was really tricky because there was no books, right? There was nothing to study. And so I wound up, there was some missionaries that were teaching the language. And so I literally had to hunker down and I learned the language. And I probably understood 70% and still probably only spoke 50%. But I'm in this beauty shop. And I have the same thing here. My Spanish is terrible and I'm in Mexico. But, you know, I can do hair talk, right?
Yeah.
I can do hair talk all day long. And, you know, I mean, I have a salon full of Mexican, you know, Mexican girls, and, you know, I can communicate with them, but I can't, like, buy a vegetable. Like, it's just over. And it's like, so I did get it. I got the language. And you know what? The sad part is I lost it. Like, if you don't use it, man, it is gone. And when I came to Mexico, I found myself making a sentence of English, Spanish, and Dari, like all in one thing. And it's like I couldn't get the Spanish in my head because the Dari was there. I don't know. I'm not trilingual, it seems.
When running the beauty parlor, the beauty school there, what was your typical routine there? Like your daily day-to-day activities? Give me like a normal day there.
You know, I'd get up early, have my tea, and then I'd get to the salon, have some more tea. And, you know, if I was teaching in the school, you know, it was just full day, full out teaching all day. But in the salon, it was it's pretty casual, right? Because we'd have appointments because it was on a compound, right? So everybody would have to go through the security guard in order to get in. And, you know, it literally was the same as any beauty shop in the States or anywhere in the world. It's like all the cultural differences and all the differences just disappeared. Now you just got a bunch of women and we're all, we trash talk the men. That was the common thing. Like, and that is, I mean, my girls, they were sometimes had the worst mouths, but they would trash talk the men and my customers, everybody, you know, that's just what beauty shops, we just have fun, right? Like they laugh and cut up and it's fun.
Now, speaking of your girls, you got so close to them. Did you have problems, I guess, because I did as a reader, not knowing what happens to them. Sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not. Unfortunately, sometimes they come to work sad. Did you have a difficult time dealing with them just like leaving you or going away?
I did. I had my hardest. I struggled with the abuse, right? Like I struggled with knowing that they were having physical abuse from their husband or whatever. I struggled with some of the young ones who were being taken advantage of by men prostituting them. And yeah, it was almost more than you can manage, right? Because there is a part of you that wanted to distance yourself because it hurt over and over and over again. And you were somewhat, you could do only what you could do. And then you were helpless. And that was tough.
Now, obviously you weren't becoming wealthy doing this. How were you making a living and surviving there? That really, you didn't get into that much in the book. How were you getting by?
Well, I had sold my house, and so I had a little bit, not a very little bit of money that I had from the house. And, you know, I did hair. So, and I lived at the beauty shop. So, I mean, everything was all in one compound. We had the school, the salon. The salon would be some days beauty school, the beauty school would be other days. And I had people rented rooms.
And you mentioned earlier, Deb, your son came. And I just shows like what a good parent you are because he came there and he wanted to help. He wanted to help that girl, Ali. Has he been back there? And what did he think of Afghanistan?
You know what? He loved it. He loved it and he loved it and hated it kind of all at the same time because he was 19 and he was a hot mess, right? And the part that I can talk about my publishers didn't want me to put this in the book, and so I didn't. But the Zach had been on drugs, mm-hmm. and my son Noah had. You know, I talked to him and he says, you know, Mom, we found needles in Zach's backpack. I says, okay. And I said, I called my girlfriend. I says, will you take Zach to the post office and get him a passport? And I brought his butt right to Afghanistan, because the thing is I thought I had more control there, mm-hmm. because, you know, you're under lock and key. I mean, you're not roaming the streets in Afghanistan. Because somebody will get you. And so, you know, I had kind of the fear of the Taliban getting him, or I could keep control over him. And he basically got his act cleaned up, which is fantastic. And, you know, it was really a tough love. But bringing my son, who had a problem with drugs, to the heroin capital of the world, you know, was possibly, but you know what, it worked, thank God. But he loved it. He thinks that it has made him into the person he is today in a good way. He the culture he embraced, he leads with his heart, and so he was like, me, it was hard for him, like, how can I save? He wanted to save everybody. That's the thing, is you can't, the getting past the wanting to save everybody, which you can't. And you had to like realize that's not your job. And that was tough though, because you get so emotionally invested in the people, and just some of the suffering was just past anything you could even comprehend. And you literally kept you from sleeping at night.
A side track question, because you mentioned saving and helping. Are there any charities or anything you recommend for people who want to help, foundations or anything to help Afghanistan?
You know, my favorite one and is Parsa. They work with like Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, and I know that the money goes directly to the projects that they are working in. And they've done so much with the country, and they've been there a very, very, very long time and are still doing really good work with the kids and stuff like that. So yeah, Parsa is probably my number one.
You went there not as a tourist. You went there to help. Then you lived there. You made it your home. Is there any hope for Afghanistan? Because, you know, forget about what the media portrays, because I go to a lot of places that the media is like, you're going to get kidnapped, they hate Americans, blah, blah, blah. Is there hope for Afghanistan?
You know what? I think Afghanistan is a very resilient nation. I think it's going to go through some, you know, it's a tribal nation. You know, there's a lot of distrust with, you know, their governments and that sort of thing. But I have to believe that there's hope for Afghanistan. I have to believe that there's a future for it, because it's such a beautiful nation with the most amazing people on the earth. I hope one day you can go to Afghanistan.
I'm trying to. He'll be listening to this, because I sent him. My boss is from Afghanistan, and I've been trying to for him to organize something where I go out there. He says hopefully soon I can make the trek out there. I'm dying to go there and just see everything about it. Forget the food and everything. You want to know how you know it's a great place? Because every single person that mentions it mentions the people. They don't mention anything else but the people. You're going to fall in love with the people. And if you walk down the street, they're going to grab you, come have tea. They're going to be fascinated by you. And just they just want to love and be like, hey, we're not the stigma that we are on TV.
That's exactly true. It is so true. They call it the web, right? They say it's like a spider's web. And once you get caught in the web, you can never get out, because it just sucks you in like that. Like, my heart aches still for Afghanistan. I will, I feel like I left a part of me there, and you know, like I probably don't go a day without missing it. It is such a captivating culture. It's so rich in history. It's so rich in their culture and their people and the and just learning about the different tribes and who does this and that. It's so spectacular. You can never know everything. You can never know enough. And then, you know, if you can get out into the provinces, it's just so beautiful. I brought my son to see where the Bamiyan Buddhas were, the largest Buddhas, I think, in the world that the Taliban blew up before 9/11. And, you know, but it was such a gorgeous area. I'm so thankful that I was able to share that with my son.
Oh, that's amazing. Now, your fascinating book chronicles your time there from like 2001 or 2 to 2006. And you really put yourself out there in the book. You admitted your flaws, you know, problems with your marriage, everything. Was this therapeutic for you? And how was the process writing a book like this? Because it covered so many avenues.
Well, you know, I had journaled the whole time just to keep my own peace of mind. I mean, it was tough, right? You see a lot of stuff that is heartbreaking. And so for me, I had to journal everything down. I wrote it all down. And so when the book I wanted to write was, because I married an Afghan and he was crazy. He was like Fred Flintstone with a rocket launcher. And he was insane. He was so funny. And, you know, and he was a really funny person. It didn't work out for us, but constantly, I had a coffee house there too, right?
Okay.
And so I was in the coffee house, and just because I needed a place that I could go that wasn't a bar, and so I needed some coffee other than Nescafe. So I opened a coffee house, and I'd call him. I'd say, I'm closing the coffee house now. It'd be about like 9 at night. I says, yeah, can I come home? And he goes, oh, you can't come home yet. There's warlords in our living room. So that was the book I originally thought I would write. There's warlords in my living room. So that was, so basically it was just, it's kind of my diary.
I was just going to ask you, because you left a bad marriage here in Michigan, and you went out there. You're talking about your marriage to Sam. How'd that marriage happen? Because I'm telling you, Deb, everything you did in this book blew my mind. But you got married out there. You just obviously did, spoiler alert. But how'd that marriage come about?
Well, I had friends. Well, you know, we all lived in guest houses, mm-hmm. right? So I had some friends that I met there that were living in a guest house, and she was Afghan and he was American, and they all, it was really hard sometimes as a single woman trying to do this whole thing. And there's no such thing as dating, right? And they kept saying, you need to have an Afghan husband. Everything would be so much easier if you had an Afghan husband. I thought, you know what? What the hell? I've had every other kind of husband, so let's just go for Afghan too, right? So I kind of was a little bit, and I think that it was kind of like he thought, well, you know what? We can check out this man woman is probably what they thought I was, because, you know, I was an Afghan woman, and so I was too forthcoming and blunt, and, you know, and I think he was thinking, well, that was just the way all Americans are. And so I think he was thinking he could advance his career. And I was thinking, oh, and he can help me with the beauty school. So it was kind of a convenience thing because I liked him, right? But you could not date. I mean, it's very dangerous to date. Like, that just cannot happen. And so we were kind of trying to see each other on the side, but that was a disaster waiting to happen. Somebody was going to get hurt by that.
I hope I'm not overstepping the line here, but obviously in American culture, it's one wife, one woman. Did you have an issue? Because he had another family in Saudi Arabia, and I don't know if you were like, hey, what the hell, I'm here, why not get married? But how'd you deal with that, he had a second marriage?
Well, you know, I was a little bit led astray on that one because, you know, in the very beginning, it was like, oh, I had to, you know, come to Afghanistan and my wife can never come to Afghanistan and I can never divorce her, which now I know it really was not led astray, but I just understood that's different culture. Like, for him to divorce a wife, even if he will then put shame on her and the children. And knowing what I know now, a divorce would have never, it's just not an option. And so I think in my head, I wanted to think, oh, that marriage is dissolved. And in my head, I mean, really, I justified it. And I really thought that she knew, because, you know, other than basically that, I thought she knew, and she didn't. And that troubled me. I didn't find that out till the very end. And then he had a child when we were married. Yeah. Oh my goodness. It was so awful. You know what? Honestly, I'm thinking, what was I thinking? Cleaning lady, she always made me tea. So every morning she would make me tea. And then she would go, I'm going to make you this special chai. I'm like, oh, I'd really like that special chai. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't find out until after I was actually back in the States. She'd been making my chai with opium.
What?
And so I...
come on.
No, I'm serious. Like, she would go, oh, Debbie, do you have a headache? I go, yeah, I have a headache. She goes, I make you this special chai. I'm like, I love that chai. I was serving it in the salon to everybody. I had no idea that she was freaking putting opium in my chai. And, like, I thought, oh, my God, I have no aches and pains. Life, you know, it's like, yeah. So I'm thinking the whole marriage, let's just chalk it up to the chai, right?
Great answer. Hey, as an author now, I personally prefer reading nonfiction books. I know you've written both nonfiction and fiction. It's a cliche author question, but I have to ask you, which do you prefer writing?
You know what? Nonfiction, you know, is really all in your stuff, right? Like, nonfiction, things get really personal. And sometimes that can be good, that can be bad, but it can be weird sometimes. I like writing, probably I feel most comfortable writing fiction, but I have to live it first. Does that make sense?
You need a storyline, an idea.
Yeah, if I have a storyline that is going to take place in Oman, which is the Zanzibar Wife takes place in Oman, I literally will get my storyline together. Then I will live that moment. Like, I have to live it. I have to see it. I have to smell it. I need to be in that story. Otherwise, I can't find that. So I think, in a sense, I like the nonfiction writing. I like it to feel like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Well, I'm not certain, right? Like, I like the non-hassle of fiction. right?
That makes a lot of sense. It does.
Yeah. But because once you are in nonfiction, you have boundaries because it's nonfiction. And so you can't, you know, like if something isn't working well in the story, not in fiction, you can say, well, let's, you know, make him older. Yes. Let's make him, doesn't need, can be a girl now. It doesn't matter, right? But so you do have way more boundaries. And so you have to find a good way to make a nonfiction book read like fiction. And fiction read like nonfiction.
Speaking of nonfiction, the one negative I have about it is when the book ends, the story, in fact, doesn't really end. And your book friggin' ended abruptly. And I'm going to quote your book. I actually wrote it down on a post-it. As I write this, in May 2006, both the Kabul Beauty School and the Oasis Salon are closed up tight. And then you mentioned widespread rioting and looting in the city. So what happened in May of 06 that made your shops close?
Well, I mean, so did you, what, did you have the book with the afterwards?
I did not. And I didn't want to Google too much because I wanted to talk to you before I started. Oh, so you put more in the afterwards?
Yeah, you know what? And I will actually email you the afterwards. It's in some of the books. And some of them it's not, and I don't really know. But there was this horrible rioting, and we did have to shut down. But actually, I didn't. I had to flee the country in 2007.
Oh.
And that was, there was a plot to kidnap my eldest son Noah, and so we had to. We had to leave very, very abruptly. And so it was, so I was there until 2007. And it was a very harsh ending.
You know what? Speaking of harsh ending, let me ask you this now. PTSD, it's obviously a serious thing. And many people who are spent time in places of despair and war, they can get it. You had a very abusive relationship, which I love that you were so open about the struggles you had here, and you were also living a difficult life like over there. Did you deal with any of that, or maybe did you block any of it out?
No, I did. I struggled with it. I sat out for about 2 years from 2007 until I moved to Mexico. And it was really hard. Like I had a hard time with fireworks and, you know, that sort of stuff. I had a hard time with feeling like I was going to get lost, like really weird triggers like that. And I actually addressed a lot of that in my, I wrote another nonfiction book called Margarita Wednesday. And it was really tough. And because PTSD is something that you don't really think you have until all of a sudden you are acting, you are having an odd reaction to something that is nothing like a breakdown in the mall or something, right? It was weird. It was very uncomfortable. And then you know that this is not, doesn't feel normal. And I went to a therapist in California, and his advice to me was I needed to go sit in a field of glowworms.
What?
Yeah, serious.
You know, you needed some of that opium tea back in Afghanistan. That's what you needed.
I know, right?
Okay, Deb, I've kept you on the line for 55 minutes, but I want to finish up with a few quick hit questions. You ready?
Yes.
First time you saw someone reading your book in public, you did what?
I was excited. Weirded out. I did nothing. I'm like,
You didn't approach them?
No, I couldn't. Like, I felt really embarrassed. But I was so excited, and I wanted to take a picture, but I didn't. That was so weird.
When you were in
Afghanistan. Because you want to say, you know, that's me, right?
Of course. excuse me. I'm the person you're reading. The first time you were in Afghanistan, what food did you miss the most from Michigan?
hamburgers, pizza.
What about where were you the moment when the book blew up? When all of a sudden it was everywhere, it kind of went viral. Where were you when you got that moment and you're like, holy crap, it happened?
Well, it kind of happened when I was in Afghanistan and I had no idea. Like, I had spotty internet. So, and then it wasn't, and I was on my way to Dubai and my agent emailed me. I was in Dubai. She says, you have to come back because Good Morning America wants to do an interview with you and your beauty school. And I'm like, what? Yeah, I know. I have no idea. Like, no idea. Not a clue.
Now, I did one quick Google search. And is there going to be a movie or was there a movie about this? Or was that in the works?
There was an option at one point, and the option is no longer existent. And so, I don't know. I keep thinking that maybe someday there will be. I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Have you kept in touch with any of the women from there? Not, I don't want to know individually, but have you kept, I hate to say characters, but they were characters in the book. Oh, awesome.
Yeah, no, I've kept in touch with a lot of them. Yeah.
Now,
I had over 200 students, mm-hmm, right?
Of course.
So the ones that have some English, but yeah, we keep in touch with quite a few.
Now, you definitely improved the lives of women there. You gave them confidence. You taught them a trade. You made them more independent, hopefully. If you could have changed one thing you did differently when you were there, what would it be?
Maybe not get married.
Here we go. Three more. During the quarantine, what shows have you been binge watching?
Oh, binge watching. Okay, let me think. I binge watch. Oh, you know, I did The Tiger King.
Okay, of course. Me too. I couldn't stop it.
I did.
It's so out of my genre, and I couldn't stop it. Okay.
I was like a train wreck. I've been watching a lot of stuff on. I'm going on the McMafia.
Okay, is it good?
Yes.
Wait, is that the McDonald's lottery thing?
No, this is like more of a mafia thing.
Oh, and no, I didn't see that. How about 90 Day Fiancé? Because there's no sports on, so my wife has me watching that. Do you believe it?
I love that. Like, I love them. Like, I can't stand it. I know it's awful, isn't it? It's like, oh my goodness. Yes, I love it.
All I watch is sports, and my wife is Filipino, and she's like, hey, there's a show called 90 Day Fiancé, or Before the 90 Days, and there's a Filipino girl. Can we watch it? I'm like, yeah. The first episode, I'm like, this is horrible. Deb, I get home from work, and I'm like, fine, let's watch another two episodes. It's cringeworthy, and yet I can't turn it off.
Oh, I know, I can't. I binge watch that one, too. I've been making a mask, you know, for like our, like everybody else. I borrowed a sewing machine. I don't know how to sew, which is the tricky part. And I thought, I can figure this out. Like, I'm YouTubing, right? How to use a sewing machine. And so I've been binge watching stupid TV. Stupid, stupid, stupid TV. And I can't stop it. Like, I'm brainless TV.
And finally, you're an author now. What book are you reading, though, right now?
You know, right now, I am reading all things about Morocco. Like, my book I'm working on now takes place in Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a luxury right now to read things that are, like, on my list of, like, the things I want to read. So I'm reading all things about Morocco, like every bit of research paper. But right, I've been rereading. I love Lisa C. And I love Jamie Ford. Jamie Ford is On the Corner of Bitter and Sweet, which is really a fantastic book. And so I started to reread that one. And Lisa C., she has Snowflower and the Secret Fan, China Girls. So I've been rereading a lot of books that, you know, I read a long time ago.
finish up now because Debbie Rodriguez, this was an absolute blast. But I want you to plug the social media, plug the books, and all that good stuff where everyone can find you.
Okay, so DeborahRodriguez.com. And I'm on Facebook, Deborah Rodriguez, author. And you can find me on Twitter. I believe it's Deb_Rod. And Instagram, just look under Deborah Rodriguez. You can find me there. I'm pretty much, you found me.
Of course I did. I started the book. I'm telling you this, Deb. This is what happened. I'm scrolling. I see the book. I'm like, okay, let me. I'm like, oh, hairdresser, not for me. I wrote to you after like 40 pages. I'm like, hey, please come on. I was going to email you, find you on Facebook. I don't even have Facebook. I was going to make an account because I wanted to do this so bad. And I'm actually going to check out your next book. So this was an absolute blast. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much. This was really fun. Thank you.
We'll talk after 90 Day Fiancé finishes up and we'll do an update, all right?
Okay, we will. Thank you.
Deb, see you later.